En séance. Une retransmission proposée par Canal Académie.
Welcome to Canal Academy, the French leader academic web radio. We propose to listen to the communication of Fotis Kafatos, Stranger Associate at Académie des Sciences in France. President of the European Research Council, he presents this institution at the Institut de France in Paris behind French academicians. In few words, the creation of the European Research Council, ERC, by the common action of the political institutions of the European Union, the Commission, the Parliament and the Council of Ministers represents a landmark event for science policy in our continent. By this action, Europe is taking a decisive step towards the formation of a common European research area. Now listen to Fotis Kafatos.
I'll tell you about the European Research Council, which I think is arguably the most interesting part of European science policy at the moment. And I'll try to put it also in the broader context of recent history in Europe. The ERC is really all about excellence. It's an excellence initiative to promote research in all fields of science, beginning with the humanities and social sciences and going all the way to engineering. It is a major initiative for Europe. It is a visionary idea, and I can say that because the scientific community has been pushing for that for a number of years, and eventually it succeeded. It is also consistent with the developments in Europe towards the European research area, the concept that Philippe Busquin, the then commissioner, had started in 2010, I think it was. So it is both a revolutionary development and also it is a secure part of the European legislation. Now, of course, that's not where the European science started. And I'll take you back for a minute to the post-war years. I'm not a historian and I'm not a political scientist, but let's remember what our continent was like after the end of the Second World War. Everything was devastated. We had lost a lot of very good people, either in the battlefields or through emigration to other parts of the world, including some of our very best. And it was also an impoverished state of Europe. And yet, at that point, at the beginning of the 50s, there was an initiative which made a huge difference, and that was the creation of the European Intergovernmental Research Organizations. It started with the physicists, and particle physicists in particular, the CERN. And then the model was used with ESO, the Southern Observatory, EMBL, and so on and so forth. And of course, Europe has pioneered this kind of intergovernmental laboratories. The latest iteration is ITER, which is, of course, a global, not even a European initiative. It's important to remember this because sometimes politicians only celebrate politics, and we should also celebrate the scientific initiatives, like the ones that I have just mentioned. And they were quite parallel, and I think ultimately really an important contribution to building Europe, as much as the political and industrial formation of the coal and steel industry was a momentous development in Europe. I'm frequently asked, what is frontiers research and do we need it? The answer is yes, for very clear reasons. It is an essential part of our civilization. Focusing on top quality research is part of our civilization, it's part of what we are, and what is going to be our future, unless we tend to that domain. Indeed, what will be our future competitive advantage? Is it going to be our population, which is aging and shrinking? Is it going to be the cheapness of our social security costs, and so on and so forth? I believe that really the only way for Europe to compete effectively is to have a leadership role in science, the endless frontier. And let's not forget also that research is at the center of the knowledge triangle. It's the center of education to innovation, the chain in which research is irreplaceable and important component. Therefore, I believe that investment in excellent people and excellent research is an imperative for our continent. It's not an option. Indeed, I would even say that we can state very much what we need. We need to both generate, attract, and to retain top talent. We must integrate our efforts and internationalize them. We must encourage the young and trust them. We must create attractive career paths for them. And that we do not do sufficiently in Europe, especially in the continent, much less so in parts like Britain. We do not deal with our young well enough, and they tend to vote with their feet. Therefore, we must create a way for Europe to not only interest the young into science, but also to keep them on track and to play a central role in the development of world science. We need, if you wish, a competitive Champions League, again using the analogy to football, where the Champions League is only a small number of players, but they set the stage, they set the standards, and we need some way of highlighting the very best in science as well. I won't go into the details of how the European Research Council, the ERC, is structured. That can be boring. I'll just give you the highlights. We are, according to the legislation, an independent scientific council, and each of these words are meaningful. We are independent. We are not part of the commission. We are scientific. The scientific council consists of 22 selected individuals, and we are a council who are able to guide the ERC as a whole. In this role, we are supported by a dedicated implementation structure, DIS, which will become an executive agency shortly, meaning in about a year, and which is the contribution of the Commission together with the funds for the ERC. But it's important to know that we are not part of the Commission, we're independent. We are representative, in fact. We have not been elected by you, the academic community, but we represent the academic community. The Commission, I must say, has played a very supportive role, and I must recognize in particular the Commissioner for the Research, the Slovenian economist Janez Potočnik, who really has embraced the ERC as the most important component of the science policy in Europe now. There was a debate for a few years after the scientific community actually started about 10 years ago to agitate towards getting a European Research Council alongside the national research councils. And this push from the bottom, from the scientific community, played a key role in establishing the ERC. Indeed, I count the beginning of it at a meeting which took place in Stockholm, where colleagues of the Royal Academy there invited several of us to have a close meeting to discuss, should we push for a European initiative for fundamental science? And it was only a dozen of us, but we all felt that it was essential that we do so. And the year after that, there was a meeting in Copenhagen run by the presidency of the European Union. And I know for sure that the organizers, in posing the question, in giving the title, as a question, do we need the European Research Council? Eurosceptic at that time, Danes, thought that the answer would be no. And to the surprise of them and most of the people in this 300 or so meeting was that we had a nearly unanimous position that this was important for Europe. After that, things have developed rapidly. 15% of the budget of Framework Program 7 was proposed and agreed by the Council and Parliament to be devoted to the ERC. That means that this year we have 300 million euros. But in 7 years, at the end of the period for which we have funding, the annual budget would be 1.7 billion euros. So it has a modest origin, but it is a significant initiative, and over a short period of time, it will become very, very important. Initially, the concept of the ERC was that on one hand, we would have the scientific council, and on the other, we would have the dedicated implementation structure. But we thought that this would be crazy, actually, that you needed to couple intimately the strategy and the implementation. And therefore, the first action that we took was to demand that there be a link between the two, and that link was to recruit a Secretary General, which we would do rather than the Commission. Indeed, that happened, and also the leadership of the ERC was selected by the members of the Scientific Council, and my colleagues gave me the honor to elect me as president of the ERC, and the vice presidents are Helga Novotny from the Social Sciences and Humanities and Danielle Esteve, whom you probably all know from France as the other vice president from the Physical Sciences. So the other thing that we insisted on is having an ERC board. The board is there to really provide the cohesion between the strategy and implementation, and it is essentially the people that I mentioned before, linked with the director of that the Commission has given us to organize the program and the administration of the program. So the point I would now like to make, because actually it's quite a historically important point, is that not only did we take these initiatives, but also we made a decision which was absolutely essential for making the ERC a success. The first meeting that we had with Potocnik and with the Director General of the Commission was in October, 2 years ago. And it was an occasion to meet each other, to say a few words about our thoughts. We spent a day talking about what our programs might be, but really it was a social event. But we decided at the end of it to make it more than a social event. I made a proposal that we must actually start tomorrow working on the ERC. And I have to say that this was a very important landmark, because it meant that although we had absolutely no formal position at the time, we simply had been invited by the Commissioner to accept to be members of the Scientific Council of the ERC, but we had no appointment and we did not even know when we would be appointed. But we said we'll start working. And we worked actually very intensely for more than a year until the February of this year we were appointed and became the official guide of the ERC. If we did not have that 1 year, we would not have been able to develop the strategy to the point where we could turn the key and start the ERC the day that the Commission appointed us. And I took some special pleasure, actually, to have completed the first year annual report of the ERC on the day that we were appointed. The second year, more straightforward, but also it was more challenging, because we had to actually begin the legislative process. Again, I won't bother you about the details, but I'll show you some of the directions that we are going. Let me first remind us that Bousquet first and then Potocnik made a very strong commitment to autonomy of the Scientific Council by not selecting the members of the Council themselves, but instead passing it on to a committee of wise people, five people, who made the selection from out of about 400 nominations that came from academies and scientific organizations. So again, this was not a political decision. It came from the scientific community. Again, October 2005 was when we actually started and became established in February 2007. What has been our strategy? Our strategy was first to keep it simple. Focus on what is clearly essential and do it well. So our first decisions were that we would have two major programs, a program directed to the starting investigators, the ones who otherwise could find no opportunities to be independent and therefore perhaps go across the Atlantic, give them sufficient funds so that they are indeed independent, and to give them a sufficient period of time, 5 years, with about €1 to €1.5 million to do what they wanted without anybody telling them what they should do. Of course, they would be selected from a larger body of applicants, and we'll come back to that. The other gap that we saw, give sufficient support to the most established, the most creative, the best scientists in Europe to do what they want. And this is what we call the advanced grant, which will start next year and will be given about €3.5 million maximum to very carefully selected people. The idea of everything that we do is the three R's: to recruit, to retain, and to repatriate scientists for Europe. Again, all fields of science scholarship are eligible, and most importantly, excellence is the only criterion. We're not going to divide so many positions to the French, so many to the Greeks, so many for the Austrians, and so on and so forth. Nationality plays absolutely no role. It plays no role also whether someone is a national of Europe or from China or from the United States or from India or from Japan. Every person in the world is eligible to apply so long as the work is done in Europe. And the starting grant also has a significant amount, about 1.5 million maximum, and the average has turned out to be about 1 million euros. The other motto, keep it flexible. Don't make complicated rules and regulations and selection. Make highly distinguished panels from the scientific community. Ask them to take on the responsibility, and they make the decisions not only who will be funded, but how much money they will get and what the indicative budgets will be. But even the starting investigators are independent. Therefore, it means that they can rebudget. It's the money that they will control for 5 years. They can do what they want. The institution is there to support them, but they rebudget and they can change their program as the dynamic develops. Moreover, and that's very important, and this was probably the hardest item that I fought to establish, and we did establish it, that the grants are portable, which means that someone may be hired to work in Finland, but if they are not satisfied with the conditions there, they can find another institution in France or in Greece and come and move together with their grant. So this is essentially the key points about the starting grant. The advanced grant, which we have just announced, will be, as I said before, addressed to the most distinguished scientists to continue, again, without regard to nationality and also without regard to age. They can continue to work even if they are retired and there's an institution that agrees to sponsor them. What do we mean by independence? We mean that they choose their co-workers. They decide the directions of their work, which can evolve. They can reallocate resources, and they can publish their scientific results without restrictions and independently. And that is the whole idea of the starting grant, and of course, pari passu, we are moving that to the advanced grants as well. I would like to go rapidly through this, simply to say that the first opportunity for the scientific community to vote on the ERC was when we opened the competition, and the 25th of April, we had the results of how many had applied. That was the deadline. Everybody was amazed that we had 9,167 applications. It really clearly showed, A, that the scientific community trusted the ERC, which hadn't begun operation yet, and secondly, that there was a lot of need for this kind of grant that we had decided to do. So the enthusiasm was, of course, a big burden and challenge for us, because having 9,000 or so applications and having only sufficient money for something of the order of 200, 250 grants to be given, it meant that only 3% success would be our success rate. We tried to make it clear to the scientific community, and particularly the applicants, that they should be prepared to have a fierce competition. And we tried to make it easier, and I think we did, by making a two-stage procedure, which means that the application is initially only an outline application that shows who the investigator would be, his or her CV, what they have published, and an abstract, essentially, of their report. And on that basis, the panels of evaluators would make the pre-selection, the initial filtering. And this was done, and out of about 9,000 applications, some of them were not eligible for technical reasons, but close to 9,000 applications were valid, and out of those, they pre-selected about 560, and invited them to write a full application and to judge them according to that application. This indeed has been done and has been completed last week. So here I can really tell you, and this is the first formal presentation of the results, what has happened. What has happened is that of the 559, to be exact, who were passed to the second stage, nearly half succeeded. And they have not been notified yet. It will take a few more days to finalize the decisions, especially the amounts of money that they will get, based on the decisions of the panels, of course. But we needed to make these sums add up. And this will be done shortly. And I think in about a week you will have all of that, maybe in Science and Nature and so on. But again, we have a large number, although only a small number relative to the demand, but it is a large number of people who will be funded to be independent young investigators, about 270 we currently estimate. The question is, suppose that the ERC succeeds, I'm convinced that it will, it shows that it will, but suppose it does, will it make any difference? I believe the answer will definitely be yes. And it has to be seen also as only part of a European strategy for excellence in science in Europe. And that's how we see it. We do not see it as supplanting the national efforts, but complementing them, and complementing them by the one thing that we have unique, which is that we have no gestureteur and no national criteria. Indeed, excellence initiatives in science are essential for the moving forward of science. I want to go on here and to remind you that excellence initiatives are not just at the European level, but also at the national level and the regional level. Just go through the list. German universities have just gone through the second phase of an excellence initiative, and the UK universities have for a number of years now established a research assessment exercise, which is rather complex and should be simplified. France has finally created the French Agence Nationale de la Recherche, which I think is also seen as an excellence initiative. And many other countries have approaches of this type. And I think that this combining of an overarching European with a national system, and also in some cases regional initiatives, that make a huge difference. In fact, let me remind you that there are regions of Europe that are very, very proactive. I happen to be one member of the scientific board of the Flanders Institute of Biotechnology, which is really impressive. Flanders has created a center of excellence by bringing together the best professors, or in some cases, not professors, but researchers, from their local universities, and created a virtual laboratory in five locations, but all in Flanders, and all interacting and commonly funded by a common pot of money. These initiatives are important because by pooling resources, you have the economies of scale, and you also have the ability to attract and make an impact across national borders. Now, let's look in more detail some of the results of the first call. In the first phase, when we dealt with more than 8,000 eligible applications, we had independent investigators applying to us from 88 countries, which you know is much larger than Europe. Europe is only 27. There are some affiliated countries like Israel and also Switzerland, but there were candidates from many countries, even the United States, even Canada, Australia, India, Japan, China. We had pre-divided the budget according to the tendencies across the world to give something of the order of 37. That actually is a minimum, because if you include the NIH, it goes way up. But something of the order of 37% to 40% we thought would be appropriate for the life sciences, 48% for the physical sciences and engineering, and the humanities and social sciences about 15%. And indeed, that's how the proposals came. Very close, actually, to what we had expected. Now, out of those, we selected the 559, and again, when we say UI, In this case, we mean the panels that we established. Let me say a few words about those panels. First pass, we established 10 panels, each of them of at least 12 people, highly distinguished, of course, not all the distinguished on it, because this is still a small number, but they were established according to a broad area of science. For example, molecular, cellular, and developmental biology became one panel. Infection and immunity is another one, and so on and so forth. We made them not strictly disciplinary because we wanted to have some margin of people going with a broader view than their specialty. And we also made it clear that we would be encouraging interdisciplinary applications, both across the three domains, but also within a domain. And this actually has worked. We have had a number of very interesting interdisciplinary applications apply and selected. Age distribution, we had defined that the eligible people would have to have at least 2 years postdoctoral experience after the PhD, and no more than 9, so that they are indeed at the stage of either starting to be independent or consolidating their independence. We had a very good response. In the phase one proposals, we had actually rather similar involvement, both of male and female scientists. And that was a very great surprise. This has not stayed until the end. There was more men than women. About two-thirds are men and one-third women. But still, it's higher than the normal in Europe. And I believe, again, it shows that there is a lot of demand for positions for independent young women. I'll give you a few examples of what happened in Greece, and then I'll show you finally some of the results in France, to give you a sense of the outcome. We have categorized the results according to nationality, which post facto we can look at, and also in terms of the location of the institution in where they will work. Because when someone applies, they apply together with an institution, which can be, again, anywhere in Europe. So what you see that initially we had more than 300 applicants from Greece. From the size of Greece, it's somewhat lower than the average, but fairly good. Of these, 11 proposals were selected for phase two. So most of the losses, in fact, happened between phase one and phase two, because that's when we went from about the total number that I mentioned, 9,000, to about 260. So naturally, most people were lost there. However, 11 proposals were selected for phase one, and that meant a 3.3% interim success rate in Greece. If we looked at different fields addressed to Greek institutions, you see that all of these cells are populated. But interestingly, and actually disconcerting to me, in the phase two proposals, those proposals which became finalists, we had absolutely no success in the humanities and social sciences in Europe, whereas we had a reasonable number divided between life sciences and physical sciences. I don't know what it means, but it is apparently a deficit of interest and or knowledge of the Greek social and humanity scientists that the scientific structure of the country needs to take into account and correct. In this part of the talk, I'll tell you that actually there's another value of the ERC, which is not just to give money, but also to provide the data to the national authorities, which may help science policy in each of our countries, as well as in Europe. And that's very important, because it is the first time that we have 9,000 applicants from which to look at the results. So here, there's a lot of detail that you are not interested in that. Cyprus, for example, had 7 proposals already, but let's go on to the next. And here, it's by institution. Yet, when we went to phase two proposals, in order, after the first selection, there was only one left from the Athens region. And instead, we had 7 proposals from another region, Crete, which actually is a small region of only 600,000, rather than 5 million. In particular, in Crete, we had both the university and the research center that we had established in the 80s, and more lower level institutions, so that actually Crete had much higher representation than any other part of Greece. And actually some of the other regions also had some. In phase two proposals, we lost quite a number, but still of the ones in Athens, which were 132, only one passed to the second proposal. And in Crete, out of 65, seven passed to the second. So I think the point that I'm making, and you'll see that in the French case in a moment, is that these are valuable data. I just have very sketchy results, but you might be interested to see that the life sciences and the physical sciences and engineering and social sciences and humanities are all well represented. About average for social sciences and humanities, a bit lower actually than the average for Europe. In the physical sciences, of course, it's very high, but also the life sciences is substantial. And that's important because many of us have felt that France has not put sufficient emphasis on the life sciences until relatively recently. We also looked at the organizations of the ones that passed to the proposal. Let's say that was duplicate. So let's look where the people who are French nationals, where did they go? Actually, you had almost 500 highly qualified French scientists who were seeking independent positions all over the world. The majority, of course, in France. But look, Germany, 20. Switzerland, 13. UK, 35. Even US and Italy. So certainly France should take into account that there's a lot of demand for this kind of positions. Now, what happened in the second stage? Here, a lot of the numbers went down, but still, you have four French people selected to go to Germany, and 47, so about 10%, go to stay in France. There were a number of people who wanted to go to Italy, only some of them succeeded, but again, success is not trivial there as well. What about within France? Well, it's not a surprise that both in the second stage and in the finalists, the ones who are going to get grants, we have dominance of the French capital and the environment, Paris. But notice also that there are a number of regions of France that have one or two. And of course, Strasbourg comes second, with five in the second stage and four in the finalists. So there will be four grants given to the Strasbourg area. Let me conclude by saying that this is a very impressive first year of an organization which did not exist except in the gleam of the eyes of the scientists and some politicians 2 years ago, and where 22 people have worked without pay, but with devoting a lot of money, a lot of time of their own to establish this system for Europe. I think the support of the scientific community was critical at the beginning. It will be critical in the coming years because we have to work against a tradition of dirigisme in Brussels, which is not consistent with science. We are making changes, we are making progress, but we need actually support from the scientific community to allow us actually to establish the kind of research council that Europe needs. And at that point, with a plea to support from you, I'll stop.
It was Fotis Kefatos, Stranger Associate at Académie des Sciences in France. He spoke about the interests of the ERC, European Research Council. It was in Paris, in Institut de France in winter 2007. More information about erc.europa.eu. Thanks for listening to us. See you soon in Canal Académie.